greetings.
This is ACS. My name is Roy. I'm our technical man. Sunday night, going about 11 p.m. It's been going on for mostly under the direction of KRIW, Dick, unfortunately, Island Key, a year and a half ago. And so now I am in it. I welcome you all here every Sunday night that we can join together and educate each other, that we can learn from each other and to make this hobby a more enjoyable experience for us all. That in mind, let me drop for a second and I will tell you, remind you of the usual link. Okay, if you can't reach me by this repeater, and some people can, you could use it, my email address. Now, that will be good for, say, mailbag questions, if you have questions that ordinarily you would ask on the technical net, but you can't get on. So this version of that, that was very popular for many, many, kind of faded away, but we could always back if it's needed. That's mailbag questions. Also, if you have any topics that you would like to discuss or hear discussed or interact on a level with, so that's another one. Puzzles. I always am looking for interesting puzzles of a technical nature that present little lessons to remind us how the universe works. So if you have any interesting puzzles that are counterintuitive especially, please share them with me and I will share them with everyone on the technical net. Or if you would like me to tap Paul of US2N on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at NASA space-related material on YouTube or the web or what have you, you can tell me about it there. So the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2s.com. Again, my call sign is alphacharlie2gulfsierra.com. I also maintain a link page. It has some interesting articles that are not related to amateur radio sometimes or not really that great for radio discussions. They're more visual or interesting YouTube that I see. Also, sometimes I have some images that sends me for his basement report. And also, I have a series of articles of science news in last week that I found interesting, so I make those links available to all of you. It's available 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, so you don't have to go to it right now, but take a look at it when you have nothing better to do. You can find that at roy.ac2gs.com. Again, the link page is just type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. We also have a chat room available. You can either get to it by going to Limark's own website and following the link, or you can type into your browser chat.ac2g.com, and that'll bring you to our chat room. We also have an audio stream that I try and maintain 24/7 of what's going on with W2VL. So if you do not have a radio or you're not within reception range, you just type into your browser technet.ac2g.com and that'll bring you an audio stream of our repeater. And always, I like to remind people, Mike, AC2NJI, has a wonderful archive of technical nets going as far back as September 2006 that's available.
Repeater timeout. Repeater timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I timed out. Probably when I got to my KC2NJI's amateurradio.tv archive. Very good place to find a lot of wisdom from amateur radio operators who have since been on silent keys. Anyway, tonight's plan is, as usual, I will ask people with questions or topics or comments to give me their first name and their call sign. I will then write it down on a list, and we will approach the list in an orderly fashion. If we have extra time, I will open the topic from amateur radio technology to any kind of technology, any form of science, medicine. We do not treat or diagnose on the air, but we can do a general discussion of health issues, medicine, and any other form of science. I'll give it a try. Then if we have still more free time, we have those articles in the science talk segment. We can discuss those if you wish. That'll lead us to about 10:15. It'll be time for Paul and the Spacenet report. He'll do that until about 11 o'clock. I'll return, put a bow on it, wish you well, and call it a night. So if my radio, my microphone, my power amplifier, and the repeater are all willing and able tonight, that's the plan. So I will drop now and ask people to please give me your first name and your call sign if you have any questions or comments tonight on the technical mess.
KD2OGB, I have never seen you this quiet at this hour, Roy. I had something in mind, but I just lost it, so it's going to take me a few minutes to figure it out.
Okay, well, you know, sometimes propagation conditions are a little better, a little worse. I'm still throwing 150 watts, which is way more than I should. In the good old days when we had a decent antenna, 18 watts gave me full quieting pretty much. So I'm looking forward to those old days coming back. I read in the recent newsletter that we're still awaiting an opportunity to have someone go up there and replace our temporary antenna that's been there for about 8 months with a nice new shiny one that's bigger, better, has a higher gain, and is located in a better place. So we'll give you a little opportunity to rethink your question. Anyone else who want to put their name down, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Yeah, this is Raymond at KD2VYY.
Okay, Raymond recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight? Okay, I'm thinking that that's you, Rich, W2BZ. Not that I could make out any of the call sign. You're mostly noise. You're falling out of the repeater. So if you could wiggle your antenna in a different orientation or boost some power and, you know, do a little magic dance, and hopefully I'll be able to hear you. So is that you, Rich? If not, please ID again. Oh, well, nothing heard. Hopefully, if that's Rich, he's checking his connections and seeing power. Craig, did you remember your question, or should I slide over and talk to Raymond first and give you a little bit more time?
I got a temporary idea in mind. I'll try to think about what my real question is later. Oh, well. I'm on Discord a lot, and I don't remember the last time we purchased a router, but it's been dropping out like crazy. Even when I first log into the computer, I gotta go over, disconnect the cable, and shut the other side off, wait about 15 to 20 seconds, then plug it back in. And I've been doing this on a daily occurrence. Do you think it might be time for a new router?
Well, that might be the problem. I have found in my long history of playing around with the Internet, routers tend to unfortunately be the weakest link. They are not really, well, for the most part, they're not designed to be terribly robust. They're manufactured in large numbers by ISPs, not particularly want us all to throttle their systems by downloading massive amounts of data. So they get hotter and hotter. I mean, just when you have nothing better to do, put your hands near your router and assess the general temperature. You can probably defrost a turkey on some people's routers. So if you're having problems and it's been a long time since you traded your router in, because usually ISPs will let you trade up and trade in for newer ones with a little bit better, faster silicon, that certainly is a good option to consider.
Maybe the next time I talk with my brother, I'll have him look at it, because I remember he used to manage it all the time, like with the password, and always would do crazy things with it, so that's one way to look at it. Plus, the last time I went to Staples, I've been looking at routers, and they're not actually that much money, so I'll probably think of something.
Yeah, again, that's the problem in some ways, that they're not really built commercially, so they're kind of flaky at times. One of the things I would certainly recommend you trying as a temporary experiment is make sure that your router is well ventilated. People have a bad habit of stacking things on top of other things, and inevitably routers are stacked from the bottom up. So make sure that it's open to air. If you have to sack it, have put rubber feet on whatever it is above it so you're not completely cutting off the air supply, and maybe blast a little bit of canned air into it to clean up the cobwebs and the dust so that you'll improve the temperature dissipation that all these routers ultimately need, or they get very flaky.
Well, I can tell you this. It doesn't sit on the floor. I can tell you that. It sits on a stool, and there's plenty. Yeah, it just sits on a stool, really, and if I need to fix it, I unplug one wire and push the power switch on the other part. I forgot which one does which, so as my terrible memory comes back, and I'm trying to figure out what my real question was, which I'm probably not going to be able to get to tonight, oh well. And then I wait about half a minute or so and then plug it back in and then wait forever for it to kick back in, disconnecting everything that I've been doing along the way up until I had to power it off to try to fix it.
Anyway, sounds like I'm getting a signal bleed through from Pennsylvania once again. I know most of you don't hear it, but I do. That's kind of unfortunately what routers very often do. Sometimes, if they're reasonably well built, they store these link optimization routines in RAM, in something that's readable when the power's gone. You know, little coin battery holds on to the memory. Otherwise, it wipes it entirely. And it starts from scratch, reassessing, polling the IP addresses locally and the best connection adjustments. And so it's a learning process that has to be done every time you fully router. So once again, the short haul suggestion, until or unless you decide to just get a replacement that's a little bit more sturdy, is to blow a little canned air through it and get it get the cobwebs out. That might improve enough to make it more tolerable. But ultimately, you know, we all should every few years upgrade our routers, unless, you know, we just do email to the kids or something, that we don't upload and download gigabytes of data.
For a gamer like me, I do a hell of a lot more than just emails, Roy. One of these days, you should see my setup. Anyway, I think that's all I could think of for now. If my actual question comes to mind, I'll pop back in. So, thank you. NetControl AC2GS, KD2OGB.
Okay, very good, Craig. Yeah, I know most people do use a lot. Even if they aren't gamers, they are Netflixers, they're streamers. And that piles up a lot of bits and bytes. And I would love to see your setup. And as I mentioned before, anyone interested in my setup can visit my little QRZ page. I have a couple of pictures of my shack, and I have a picture of my three-screen displays set up for TechNet. So if anyone's curious of what it looks like during TechNet night, just go to QRZ and look me up. So I thank you, Craig, for your question. If you remember your other question later on into the night, there'll be probably more than a few opportunities to ask it. So I thank you. Raymond, KD2VYY, what's your question or comment for tonight?
Yeah, it's a question on HF antennas. I'm starting to look towards getting the HF rig set up, and I'm looking over certain types of antennas, and the one I'm looking at is the NFED 8010s. But the question I have is basically on the pattern of an 8010. If I use it as a reverse L, or an L shape, and I set it up in a horizontal plane, what is the pattern on this thing? Is it omnidirectional, or is it more directional, perpendicular to the running of the wire?
If you keep it in the horizontal plane, it will be primarily a horizontally polarized antenna. If you sit mostly in the vertical plane, it will be mostly vertical. If you mix and match, it'll be a very complicated elliptical type of a pattern, which is to say partially horizontal, partially vertical, because really all polarization angles are more ellipses. In extreme cases, the ellipse kind of collapsed down to a linear orientation, but there's always a little bit of ellipse going on. So that's the best answer that I could give you. It sort of depends upon its orientation in free space. In addition, as opposed to something simple like a standard half-wave center-fed dipole, there are multi-nodes that are in effect as you transition from one frequency to another on the NFED. So the pattern for an NFED is highly dependent upon its length, upon its position, space, and also on the frequency that you're trying to resonate it at. So NFEDs are very complicated structures. You can run simulation software that's for free. It's not the easiest software to figure out, but there's a lot of YouTube. And you can kind of get a sense for the different nodes at different frequency points. They're not 100% accurate because there are variations. And again, your NFED in free space is going to have a significant impact upon those nodes. But it's a complicated thing. NFEDs are simple in design, but complex in function.
Well, thank you for that. It's part of the explanation. But is the main lobe of the of an NFED antenna perpendicular to the wire direction, or is it like an omnidirectional antenna?
Most of the, again, it depends because of the multinodal tendencies of an NFED, but a significant amount of the RF is going to come out towards the portion of the antenna feed point. So if you have a long length of horizontal NFED and then it hangs a right angle and becomes vertical, say two-thirds or three-quarters along the NFED, it'll primarily act as a horizontal oriented antenna as opposed to a vertical.
All right, well, thanks for that explanation. Back to Ned, this is KD2VYYO.
Y2Wing?
Yes, Tony.
There's actually a good website, V2NSB, the V2NSB2UniformTo.NovemberSierraBravo.com. He's got some really great illustrations that answer questions precisely and how it fractures the low frequency.
Okay, very good, Tony. You want to repeat that once or twice so that everyone can scribble it down, and I'll scribble it down and put it on my link page.
Victor Uniform 2, November, Sierra Bravo, .com, 2NSD.
Okay, very good. So I assume he plugged it into some antenna simulation software and generated the graphics. Those can be very, very informative. You have to kind of understand that this is a kind of a theoretical construct, though, that once you have, once you put it near ground, little things happen, and once you put it near other objects, because most of these modelings works best in free space, and unless you work for NASA, none of us work in free space for the most part.
Completely agreed. I do a lot with NFED halfways, and I'm a big fan of them. I do a lot of parts on the air stuff. And the assumption is that I have no idea where it's going, but they always seem to work.
Okay, very good. Yeah, well, my guess, even if I didn't have any experience with them, is that they pretty much have to, because a lot of people like them. You know, you get points for being convenient, but you also get a lot of points if it works, and a lot of points taken away if they don't work. So NFED seems to be a kind of, they're hitting its peak, like any kind of fashion statement or technology. Things kind of ebb and flow. 10 years ago, it seems like everyone and their brother was talking about G5RVs for some reason. Now NFEDs are very, very popular, and I can't see a reason why they won't continue to. They're much less fastidious than G5RVs. G5RVs, although as complicated as any NSAID on a theoretical basis, almost anything affects them. Some people love them, some people hate them just because of that variable nature when you actually hang them. So good to hear that about the NSAID. And Raymond, I hope you wrote that down. I'll have the link available on my link page later on tonight, if you didn't. But if you did, check it out. I really should do more with these antenna simulations, but I haven't been writing that many articles lately. I find them very useful to point out things. I did an article that demonstrates why we talk about lowering a half-wave center fed close to the ground to make it a near-vertical incident skywave. The simulation software demonstrates low, starting off rather low, and as you bring the antenna closer and closer to the ground, the reflections and such cause the takeoff angle to go up to a 90-degree angle, going straight up into the sky, making it a sky burner. So they're very useful demonstrations. So I got to get back to that someday. But thank you very much, Tony. Thank you, Raymond. Anyone else with any comments about this? Okay, nothing much people have to say. Anyone with any questions of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign or comments or what have you.
Roy, you have a comment out there. You didn't hear it.
Okay, no, I did not hear it. Whoever wanted to make a comment, please hit that push to talk again.
Yes, thanks. This is Kilo Alpha 2, Lima Alpha Charlie. There is another website that describes the patterns for an NFET half-wave in an inverted L, qsl.net, KK4OBI. In fact, he does a whole series of NFET half-wave configurations, and it's quite informative. Back to Ned.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. What's your first name?
Lloyd, out in Ridge, New York.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other comments out there, please hit that push to talk. I have often said Google is your friend. You could Google and find all kinds of very interesting articles. There's a very large number of smart, clever guys who have much of the software is free. Some features require unlocking. One of the most well-known is going to become free soon because the guy who writes it is retiring and won't be able to improve upon it. So he's going to just give it out to everyone without a license requirement soon. But there's a lot of people who use those programs, generate a lot of images, a lot of people who do their own experiments and publish it, not only in QSC, but other magazines and a lot of web pages. So as always, Google is friends.
AB6MB.
Yes, Jeff.
Okay, Roy, sorry, I'm having trouble getting it to transmit. Yeah, the software you're talking about is called EZNEC, Echo Zulu Nancy Echo Charlie. EZNEC, that's Roy Llewellyn, W70L, I think. But yeah, that will be free after the first of the year, and it's actually his professional version, which is really nice. So yeah, I highly recommend that if you've got an interest in antennas, to download that software, it's great. And there's a ton of videos on how to use it. Once again, that's EZNEC, Echo Zulu Nancy Echo Charlie. Back to your right. Thanks a lot, AB6MB.
Thank you, Jeff. AB6MB, Jeff, is net control operator for the Papa Network antenna TechNet every Friday night at 10 p.m. our time. He's on the Papa Network. There are different ways that you could get to that, either EchoLink or if you have hotspot capability, anything that works with XRF. There are a lot of other places that have gateways to the Papa Network. It's a large West Coast repeater chain, and they do very good work. And Jeff, AB6MB, has a great antenna technical net every Friday night at 10 p.m., so I would suggest you you try listening and learn a few interesting things. So I thank you, Jeff. Yeah, it's a very interesting piece of software. It's not one of those things that you pick up like a simple word processor or a simple drawing program. It's somewhat like a CAD CAM software, if you've ever played with those, where it's kind of difficult initially to grasp the controls and how to get things done. But as Jeff mentioned, there's loads and loads of YouTube. There are websites available. There are sample files which owe you someone else who designed an antenna, and you could kind of play around with their design and modify it. So if you are at all interested in antenna theory, it's a very nice thing to play around with. It gives you a much better sense for what's going on with a given type of antenna. So thank you very much, Jeff. Anyone else with any comments, please?
K2GJE, a small computer question.
Yeah, sure, Ed.
K2GJE, if you don't have enough USB ports on a laptop, and there's a box you can buy, you plug into one of the USB ports, and it gives you other ports. What is that box called, over?
They are called hubs. They are USB hubs. In the olden days, Ethernet used to have hubs, but they became more intelligent, and most Ethernet-based multi-connections are now switch-based, so that they actually play an active switching from one port to another port to optimize transport of information. But USB hubs are very, very common. Amazon sells them. You can get powered ones, which I would tend to suggest people use powered ones. You can use passive ones, but if your devices are going to use up any significant amount of power, it's problematic to draw too much power from a single USB connection on your laptop. So if it's quick and dirty and it's not something that's running on the USB power supply, you can get a passive USB hub. But I find that an active one with a wired power supply that connects along with the USB connection is best. They come in ports that have 2 ports, 4 ports. I've seen 16 ports. I use something that's almost like 16 ports for my computer with my radio, because I have so many radio parts that plug into USB connections and such. So the short answer version would be, they're called hubs, available on Amazon, any price range you can imagine.
Hubbo Zulu?
Yes, Rich.
Second, only getting one that is powered, that has a wall wart that you plug into the wall, and then it has a little hub where you plug in your USB connections, because in the long run you're going to run into something that needs that power, and if you don't have a powered hub, you're not going to be able to run whatever it is. So I second Roy's opinion on the powered type of hub.
Yeah, I mean, in addition, unfortunately, there are some complications in this world. The simplest, let me just check that I have it. Okay, the simplest hub is the old standard USB-A type of connection. It's the first USB that anyone really was familiar with. And it'll have just a row of USB-A ports available. Unfortunately, nowadays, there's USB Mini. Mini kind of went out about a week after it was in, because the duty cycle was very poor. It was mechanically not as strong as any other design. So most times you'll never see a Mini. You'll see a USB Micro, and now you're starting to see something called a USB-C. which is a symmetrical connector. You can connect it and rotate it 180 degrees and still connect it, and it works perfectly fine. Matter of fact, Europe, the European Union just passed a law that they want all cell phones to use the USB-C to charge. So this is going to impact Apple's iPhones a great deal because they are still sticking with their Lightning connector instead of a USB-C.
The US-2N?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, my hub is got connections, but it doesn't plug into the wall. To power into another USB, and a B is of course plugged into the wall. So it's a strange setup, but it works really well. You know, it's got a blue light. You can see it when it's plugged in, and then it's got four outputs, and it comes out of, I don't know, I think it was $20. It was very inexpensive. I couldn't believe it. I've had it a couple of years. Works well. Back to you, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, over time, this subject has grown incredibly more complicated. You know, back about 10 years ago, it would take me about 3 seconds to describe everything I know about hubs. In addition to having either USB-A, USB-C, micro and mini inputs and outputs, they also sometimes will stick memory readers. So there'll be slots in some of these hubs that you can insert a SD card or a micro SD card or a C flash card, all kinds of memory cards. So that's another aspect. Also, now, just to make it incredibly complicated, is there are different charging algorithms. If you use one of these to charge one of your cell phones or your iPad or some such, in the old days it was simply 5 volts and I think 5 watts. Now, depending upon the chipset that's in the USB hub, it is capable of shaking hands with different devices and offering up different currents and different voltages. It's sometimes called quick charge. There are a whole bunch of different protocols, and so every hub kind of has another chip in it that is slightly different and that offers a group of different charge options. You'll sometimes see with, on Amazon with the discussion of hubs how many watts it's capable of using, anywhere from a terrible 5 watts, which is the original, all the way up to 100 watts. In special cases using gallium nitride, which I talked about a couple of months ago on the technical net. You could buy simple, you could buy incredibly complicated. It sort of depends on what you want and what you need. If you don't need it to charge anything, you don't have to worry too much about the multiple options the charging available for USB connectors. But if you do have an interest in that, you might want to keep an eye and make sure that your new hub is capable of charging your devices as quickly as you want them to charge. So Ed, did we answer your question?
W2BZ?
Yes, Rich.
Roy, I think what you're referring to with USB-C and I think the other one's USB-S or whatever, the older ones, those are the cables that you're referring to, and the configuration of the plugs on the end of one side of the cable, but on the other side of the cable, as far as I can see, they're all uniform and they'll all plug into any USB hub that's out there. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you're not wrong about your personal experience, but if you take a look at Amazon, you will see that there are hubs that insert into either desktop or a laptop that is not a USB-A connector. It's a USB-C connector. So that's one option. Other options are, a lot of times you'll find in very modern hubs, that they offer other type of output ports. In addition to a row of USB-A's, they often have one or two USB-C's. So the world is slowly changing, and eventually, probably in 15, 20 years, everything will either be USB-C or someone will have thought up yet another port to confuse us all. But things are slowly shifting to USB-C. So although the standard hub is a row of USB-A connectors, little by little, they're selling products that have C connectors built into the design in the box.
But the C connector is really one side of the cable, which could be C or A or Z or Q, whatever they're going to come up with. That's just one side of the cable. The other side is all standard. At least I've never seen the other both sides be USB-C, where both sides have that roundish molded connector on the end. I thought the USB-C referred to just one side of the cable, the other side being pluggable into any COM port.
Well, not necessarily. In the old days, that's the usual way because USB-A was the major port. Minis and micros were kind of designed for very small form factor devices, so you usually plugged a big A connector into your computer or your laptop and maybe a mini and micro into your cell phone. But times have changed. I have C2C cables. They're not that unusual anymore. Some people need them because they'll have a device like the new iPads are C's. True, you can plug in a C on one end and you can plug in an A on the other end. But new computers now are coming with multiple C connectors, so you don't need to screw around with adapters. You just plug it from the C in your iPad to the C in your laptop, and you're done.
Well, I can't say that I'm very much up with designs of USB hubs, but I do know this. Get the powered one, and when I don't know what I'm doing on Amazon, let's say I don't know which is the best hub, I know my price range, what I'm willing to spend, and then I do two things. I look for how many reviews there are, and let's say there's one that has 21,000 reviews and one that has 8,000 reviews. It's a no-brainer to go to the next step on the 21,000 reviews and plug that into Review Meta. That's reviewmeta.com. Let me let it drop. What they do is they run algorithms testing the reviewers and the reviews, and they will come up with a pass, fail, or neutral. In other words, a lot of these reviews are padded by people who are either paid to pad them, the companies themselves, or whatever, and these algorithms, these guys at Review Meta have come up with, and there's one other one I can't think of. There's another site that does this. All you do is plug in the address to the Amazon device that you're looking at, and it'll tell you pass-fail whether these reviews are true or not. So I look for the most reviews, but I don't depend on that alone. Then I go to Review Meta. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. There are a bunch of sites like that. I have a plug-in to my web browser that sort of accomplishes that. Amazon recently has kind of thrown out a large number of major Chinese manufacturers because they found evidence that they were gaming the system and faking the reviews. So that's a very common one. It sort of depends upon what you're looking for. If you're looking for some kind of standard thing that's used by everyone, that's been around for a while, The number sold is a pretty good indicator. Plus, you take a look. I don't take a look at the 5 stars or the 1 star. I take a look at the 4 stars or the 3 stars, and I think I get a better sense for what's going on there. Of course, if you want to live on the bleeding edge, that's something, you know, these things end up having just been released a month or two or three ago, so you're not going to really see a large number of reviews. So that's a little bit more dangerous place to live on.
W2BZ. I also look at the 3s and 4s, and I discard the 5s and the 1s and the 2s. I think 4s are the most accurate, but the people who are giving it a rating of 4 probably know that too. So that's why I go to Review Meta also. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, understandable. I mean, I get a sense of the guys who give it 1 star, usually I get the sense that there's something wrong with them. Because the nature of a 1 star, well, there's two major natures. One I take into account, the other I don't. When, you know, someone says I got it and it was in pieces, or I got it and it worked for a day and it broke, I take that into account to a degree. You get a lot of these curious people who don't seem to know how to turn things on. And they'll say that, you know, I got it in the mail, it didn't have any instructions, I didn't know how to use it, I pounded it against the wall, it didn't do what I wanted, and I sent it back and I hate it. Well, you know, a lot of Chinese stuff, unfortunately, is not well documented. But again, Google is your friend, so if you Google stuff, you can find about all kinds of interesting things of how to use them. And so just doing that alone kind of obviates that particular reason for a mark. Any other comments on this subject? Ed, I hope we solved your problem and then some.
And now, will you take another question?
Certainly, Ed. Please.
E2GJE, the last couple of weeks you've been talking about NFEDs. Because basically they have two anchoring points. I was just curious how people are feeding these NFEDs. If it's a half wave, it's definitely quite a high impedance at the end. If it's a random length, it varies. And most people nowadays are not using open wire line. I assume they're using a ballon to make a match. What do they do with the other connection of the ballon over?
Okay, I mean, usually in the documents that I've read, if you're going mostly for a full wave, for a full half wave resonant, that's where the 49-to-1 ballons are used. If you're going for a random length, that's where I think most people use a 9-to-1 ballon. And it's very important that they have a very good ground, because their ground is pretty much going to act as a counterpoise and remove a great deal of RF from their transmission line. But people out there who use NFEDs all the time, please hit push to talk and tell us what you use as a ballon and a counterpoise and all that good stuff.
WB2GXM.
Yes, GXM.
Good evening, Roy. If it's random wire, if it's going to be used as multiband, use a 9-to-1 ballon or auto transformer, as it were. And the counterpoise tends to be the coaxial cable. You need to put a choke ballon at the rig, not at the antenna, at the rig, so that your coax gets a chance to beat part of the counterpoise.
Okay, Rich, it's good to hear you. That's one option. A lot of ballons that I've seen for NFEDs also have a grounding wire that acts as a counterpoise. Have you ever used any of those?
That can work. It's a matter of experimentation to find out what works best. Either the counterpoise or the shield of the of the feed line or both. But definitely put a choke ballon at the rig, or when the coax comes into the shack, put a choke ballon so that you do not get RF in the shack.
Yeah, I would agree with Rich. You know, physics doesn't let you get away with anything. And so the price that you pay, among other things, for the NSAID, it's its tendency to have common mode signals ride right down your transmission line and into your shack. And so the ballon will help to a degree, but RF chokes are necessary as well. Otherwise, you can flood your shack with RF. In the old days, that might just kind of distort your microphone preamp. Nowadays, it'll wreak havoc with the computer and shack. USB devices especially are very, very sensitive to picking RF up in their cables and just crashing the USB ICs and such. So anyone out there who plans to experiment with NSAIDs, you certainly, in general, with amateur radio, it's always a good thing to have some ferrite cores, RF chokes. I had to RF choke a signal link device that turns audio signals into signals, and it was bleeding through from my RF. So ferrites can do all kinds of fun things. I mean, they're not, they don't do everything, but they do a lot of things. So it's probably a good idea to have you know, a little shoebox full of them someplace in the shack.
A2SCP?
Yes.
Hey Roy, how you doing? I've got an NSAID Heffler
1, KBG2RY,
of course with their tech support and designer of their antenna. It has a 49:1 ballon at the antenna, and I asked if I should put a choke as well, you know, before that. And he said I would not need it as long as you have your coax grounded before it goes into the shack. In my case, I have the ballon grounded, so there's a grounding nut on the outside of it. I ran that down into a copper pipe in the ground, and then the cable goes along my house and into the shack, and I have lightning arresters with a good ground at that point as well, and the two grounds bonded together. He told me that would work much better than putting a choke. And I have not had any RF issues whatsoever. And it does work, but I'll throw that in there. K2SCP.
Okay, Chris. By the way, David, recognized. We'll get to you in a second, David. Theoretically, yeah, if you have a good ground, it lessens the need for an RF choke. But ferrites don't introduce any loss whatsoever, except for, you know, $2 that it costs you or something. So I would always be a belt and suspender sort of a guy. It's nice if you can have a good ground. Unfortunately, most people that I know don't really accomplish a great ground. They settle for a kind of medium ground. So all things being equal, negligible cost for a ferrite RF choke doesn't really have any negative impact on the design of the antenna. So it's sort of like belt and suspenders. So even if you do have a ground, I don't really see any negative to putting some RF chokes in line with that. The only problem of putting RF chokes where they don't belong is certain types of antennas that you segment as a counterpoint. If you block them with common mode, you're going to block their usefulness as a counterpoise and limit the benefit of the antenna. But other than those reasons, RF blocking ferrites don't really impact on the utilization of an antenna, in my experience. David, you wanted to say something?
QSL. Hello, Roy. Good evening, everybody. I put ferrite beads by my antenna, on antenna side, on the shack side. My question is, you know, your jumper cables, make sure your jumper cables are working 100% that can also affect it. And also the jumper cables, the settings for the auto tuner or manual tuner, and the settings on the radio for the tuner, I think that can also make a difference.
Well, you know, it's sort of depending upon what you're talking, what's the problem at hand. For the most part, we were talking about the proper balance transformation in order to have an impedance that your antenna tuner can work with. In the case of a resonant half wave, you're going to have impedances on the end of as high as 3,000 ohms. So in order to get it relatively near the point where any, you know, run-of-the-mill antenna tuner can work at, that's why people use the 49-to-1 transforming balance. If you're using it as a multi-band, non-resonant piece of wire, then practice has demonstrated it's probably best to keep transforming balance to 9-to-1 and handle the rest through your antenna tuner. Then we were talking about counterpoises and blocking of common mode. Lengths of jumper cable, as long as they're intact, that they don't have any kind of mechanical damage to the connector or to the cable, isn't really much of a factor. There's a slight attenuation, but not very high. It's not going to introduce any RF common mode once it's been blocked further up. So it's always good to have high quality equipment, including jumper cables. Some people just old cables as jumper cables, and sometimes that works out, and sometimes it doesn't, because you know, sometimes they're rather old and weathered.
Well, Roy, isn't the goal to get as much signal out as possible? If there's any kind of dysfunction of the antenna tuner, there is chance that less signal will get out. I guess the best to do is to examine the entire system one part at a time to make sure that maximum signal gets out.
Well, yeah, in theory, you are quite right. In practice, it can be difficult. Sometimes people don't have the proper equipment. In my mind, certainly doing a visual inspection of a run of cable is the first thing that you do, because you might pick up things. Animals do bite through them. I've had a couple of cases of some animal kind of just chewing up my cable. But, if visual inspection doesn't demonstrate anything, although a lot of people will tell you to use a voltometer, that's nice, but it doesn't tell you the whole picture because transmission lines are not DC devices. They're RF or AC devices. And so something like a vector network analyzer is probably much more useful. You can run it in time domain reflectometry mode, which basically just sends little bounces of RF back and forth and assesses whether there's any impedance changes. You want to see a straight 50 ohms all the way from one end of your transmission line to the other. If there are discontinuities, that's a bad sign. But you wouldn't pick that up in a voltometer. So, yeah. Sometimes you can get a little bit over-obsessed with maximum energy transfer. You have to keep in mind that one S unit on your radio is a quadrupling of power. In order to get something that's, say, S6 on your receiver to an S7, and it's 100 watts of power output, you have to boost it to 400 watts. So if you're talking about, 2% or 3% loss, it's a shame, but it's not going to really impact a great deal on your ability to fulfill your hobby.
QSL, Roy. I'll say, from my experience, had about maximum signal, has been radio settings. Here I had on this radio, it said auto-tune. And I have an auto-tune, turn it on, auto-tune. And I said, you know, the tuner was tuning while I was talking, you know. And when I turn off the auto-tune, you know, I was able to get much more signal out and people could hear me better. And also the tuner would tune when I pushed the button, but tune while I was talking.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of labor-saving devices kind of unfortunately end up being more of a nuisance than a benefit. For people who really don't like to twirl knobs, and there are people who love to twirl knobs, but some people don't, auto-tuners are reasonable devices. I own both types. I sometimes will turn off the auto-tune function once it's tuned up to my liking, or sometimes I'll tweak it to a little bit better because the algorithms kind of compromise time. If you want something that's a perfect 1.0, it takes a lot longer than if you settle with a 1.1 or a 1.2. So, you know, you have the option of either change the setting on some of them or you can put it into manual mode sometimes and adjust it yourself and lock out the auto-tuner. It is a problem with auto-tuners that I find annoying occasionally because of the way they work. Every time they transmit, they detect what the BizWi is. If it reaches a certain point, it will go into an auto-tune circuit and go right, left, and center trying to find the correct setting and might skew your BizWi even worse before it settles down. So again, in those cases, that's why I like to have machines that can have the auto-tune shut down when I want to. But, you know, like any labor-saving device, it works for some people great and other people not so great.
USL Roy, fine business. Yeah, I think that my biggest problem getting signal out, you know, on both radios that I've had, you know, was I had the wrong for them, and I guess I had to learn the hard way. And with the auto-tune, I don't really need that, but maybe an able tune is a better thing for both radios, and I had to go to YouTube to search for my video to how to do it. But for some reason, I guess I missed on one or two details, and those were very important.
Okay, yeah, I mean, you gotta learn the details, I guess, is the moral of the story. Like anything, there's the right way and the wrong way of using a lot of equipment. A lot of us don't like to read manuals and don't really get mentored by people, so we sort of try and figure it out ourselves, and some of us get it right, and some of us get it terribly wrong. You know, I knew a guy who had radios for, I don't know, what, 15 years before, you know, someone... he was having problems with the push-to-talk controls, and someone suggested that he just try out Vox. And his response was, what the hell is Vox? So there's a guy who doesn't read the instruction manuals, so it's always good to read the instruction manuals, at least once. Then you can put it away someplace. Because, you know, it might give you insight into a device that you lack the first time. So it's always useful. So know your controls, know the options that all your equipment can give you, and you try and optimize things to work best for you. Everyone's different. Some people work best totally manual. Others work best totally automated. Most of us are someplace in the middle.
QSL, I would say that the moral of the story is you have to know what questions to ask. You get to a certain place what you need to find out. Would you agree?
Ultimately, yes. When you're just starting out, you don't know anything. For the most part, people don't know what the right question is. If you teach them enough just general knowledge about the subject, as time goes on, they can hone their questions more and sharper and sharper and more well-defined. And so, yeah, it's always best to know a subject enough to be able to frame the proper question. I have had more than a few people ask me something where I truly did not understand what they were asking. It was not a very distinct question. It was kind of very vague. So all things being equal, the best way to get the right answer for your problem is to know what the right question is for it.
QSL, I agree. I don't know what kind of question to ask group you're looking for.
Well, again, it really has to do with your underlying foundation of knowledge. If you don't have any foundation of knowledge yet early on into this hobby, we all didn't, we don't exactly know what questions to ask. Usually, what you get is the most simple question imaginable. You get, what radio should I get? What antenna should I get? What should I do with both of them? So to the point where when I was doing the exams before the pandemic, I wrote up a little handbook of getting started and the first few things that you have to think about in terms of this hobby. But, you know, like an onion, you learn those things, and then that leads to other questions. You know, what kind of antenna? Well, is it vertical? Is it horizontal? Is it going to be mounted any particular ways? What band do you want to use it for? How far do you want to use it? How much power do you want to put through it? And the questions just keep on going. And, you know, people with 6 years of experience in this hobby still have questions. We all have questions. That's why we all come here each Sunday night, to hopefully learn a little bit more.
USL, we start with a particular layout for the antenna. We put it up, we set it up, we run the cables, and we test it. And over the course of time, there's changes that could happen to an antenna, you know. So you have to inspect every single point on the antenna from the shack all the way up to the antenna feed and then the antenna itself. And, you know, if a person knows, has an idea of what they're for, you know what they can improve or what they can fix in it, you know, maybe this happens over the course of time.
Well, it sort of depends on the hobbyist. There are hobbyists that decide, you know, because someone told them on a design, and they go with that design, and they stick with that design, and they stay with that design, and they might tweak it a little here or a little there, but they stick with that design. And on the other end of the spectrum, there are guys who tried one type of antenna, were not happy with it as they thought they might, put up another antenna, experimented with another, and before you know it, they have an antenna farm, you know, filled with an acre of designs that they got from websites or magazines or books, or they made it up themselves. So again, it sort of depends upon the individual. Most of us tend to not be as experimental as that. We buy commercial antenna designs that have been sold and used for at least 20, 30, 40 years, if not 100 plus years. And then we just kind of tweak it around here and around there. So, you know, that's, again, the beauty of the hobby. You make of it what you wish based upon your own strengths and weaknesses.
I got a computer question, WHCDL Mobile.
Certainly, I'm up for a computer question.
Okay, and hello to everybody. I happen to be in the car, but I'm going to be talking in a minute. And one day you will hear me back. I'm gathering a couple of nice articles on different things to talk about. But one thing about computers, especially dealing with changes that occur because of obsolescence or what have you, sometimes it could be a little bit frustrating. The issue that I came across this past weekend was relatively simple, but to try to figure out why it occurred, I'm still perplexed. And that is accessing QRZ using Windows 7. I happen to have a Windows 7 computer that I've been using for a long time. And up until 2 days ago, I had no problem accessing QRZ. My Windows 10 computer has no issues whatsoever. My Windows 7 does. And what's happening is, specifically, it's not recognizing QRZ because it says it's not secured. You know, the little HTTPS is now crossed off. The S is missing. And it says you are reaching an unsecured site. I can no longer give it to you. This is happening on Windows 7. It's not happening on my Windows 10. So then somebody, I was overhearing a conversation, and let me just let it drop. So I'm wondering if anybody else had this experience. Somewhere, some way, I heard someone talking about Windows 7. I know it's not being supported anymore, but something about the access of different certificates, I guess they call it. So I'm wondering if, Roy, you've experienced this, where I can no longer... Oh, by the way, I'm using Windows... I'm using Google Chrome. Somebody suggested try Microsoft Edge, which I never had, which I never installed, actually. I've heard about it, but I never installed it. Or Firefox. I did try Microsoft Edge, and I had the same problem. It did not work. Firefox, I had a phone call, and I forgot to try it. I have to see if that's going to work. But Google Chrome, for some reason, stopped working. My Windows 7. As far as accessing QRZ, sound familiar? Any issues? Any information, I should say, Roy? What do you think of that? WHCDM.
Okay, it's a little bit complicated. There is two types of hypertext protocols. The old one was HTTP. Pretty much everyone remembers people droning on. Websites where they would include http://www.... So that was the first way, HTTP. Then there was secure HTTP, which you'll recognize on most of your browsers are HTTPS. HTTPS includes a secure layer with a security certificate that has to be paid for and updated on websites. In the old days, if you typed in the old HTTP, you got the HTTP page. If you typed up the HTTPS, you got the security page. Over time, browsers now shift everything over, no matter what you type it, into HTTPS. And if it's not configured correctly with a recognized security certificate, it does not allow you to get onto that web page. I haven't had that experience with QRZ, but I've had that experience with other websites. So something apparently got corrupted as far as your security certificate in that computer. How you go about getting around that changes for each circumstance. So unfortunately, I can't offer you a quick, simple fix. But that's what's going on. It's trying to go through a security without a proper certificate that should allow it to go into it.
82 MDB.
Yes, Bob.
Yes, I have the same problem, and it didn't show up until, for me, I didn't notice until yesterday or last night. And I'm running a Mac, but I have an older version of Mac OS. It's maybe 5 years old or so. It's people who know Mac OS is it's called El Capitan, which is OS 10.11, think they're up to like 15 now, and they've actually gone, well, actually they've gone up to OS 11. Anyway, my experience is a bunch of websites, not all, but a whole lot, were not working in Google Chrome. They did not work in Safari, that same exact error that Andy described. But so far, today I switched to Firefox. So far, I haven't had a problem on Firefox. So to throw a little more data into this question, I'm baffled by it too, but your answers are... Anyway, back to that.
Hey, it's Craig.
Yes, Jack.
Oh, it's Andy.
No, I think AHK was in there too. Was he?
Yeah, this is AHK, WB2AHK. I recently had some trouble with my Windows 7, and I solved it. I couldn't get to a site I always get to, and all I did was go to a restore point, an earlier restore point on my computer, and it took like 10 minutes to restore it to an earlier restore point and put the old software in, and bingo, I was able to get right through. Over.
Okay, that's interesting. So basically something corrupted the security certificate and you were able to restore before that corruption and solve your problem. This is something, depending upon whether or not people have set up restore points on Windows 7, that they can do. Unfortunately, quite quietly, Microsoft disabled restore points in Windows 10. Many of you out there may not have even noticed it, but go try and find your restore point on Windows 10. Lots of luck with that. Yeah, that's a possibility. It's more of just rolling back from before you got a corrupt certificate. There should be some workaround to get the proper certificate for the browser. Now, one of the unfortunate problems with browsers these days is that they're all kind of the same under the hood. It's sort of like if you open the hood and the engine was all made by the same guy. Edge is a new Microsoft browser. This is kind of Edge 2. Edge 1 was a Microsoft product that everyone hated. So they brought out really Edge 2, which is a Chrome browser under the hood. Firefox is really a Chrome browser under the hood. So they're all Chrome browsers, unfortunately. They're slightly different here and there, but not terribly different, unfortunately. So it may help with the certificate. It may not help with the certificate.
Hi, W8CDL. Let me just add something. The other station, the first, I think it was Bob. And hello, Chad. How you doing? Unfortunately, Bob, you were very noisy. And I did not get everything you said. You're just about holding the repeater. But I'm happy that you said, and I heard this, that you had the same issue. Because I just want to mention, then I have to leave the car because I'm just parked here. I got to go into a store. It just so happened I heard someone talking about something to do with a certificate and having to do with Windows 7 that is now an issue which wasn't just until a few days ago. I've always used QRZ on my computer that has Windows 7 on it, never had a problem until 2 days ago, actually 3 days ago. Then I heard somebody talking about the same issue. So apparently, it's not my computer, it's per se. I guess it's the browser, which I said is the Google Chrome that I've been using on Windows 7, and having QRZ not recognizing that security certificate. So it's coming up automatically as a non-secure site and won't let me access it. As I said, Windows 10 works fine, no problem. So I could try Firefox, because I didn't have tried that yet to see if that works. I'm kind of curious if it would. And of course, it leads up to the question, you know, why is there a difference between one browser and another? It's so confusing. Why can't they just make one browser, to do the job, rather than having Firefox and Edge and this and that? It's crazy. Anyway, I gotta run because I do have to go inside a store before they close. So I just thought I'd bring that up. And I did call Ken, KWC, and spoke to him on the phone about this. See if he had the issue. But very good, Neil. I was gonna say Neil. Roy, thanks. I know you're knowledgeable about it. It's always a mystery dealing with computers, especially if they make changes they don't even know about. Thanks, Roy, WHCDO.
You're welcome, Andy, and I look forward to Andy's Corner one of these days. Have you considered, have you installed the latest, greatest version of these browsers, or are you using old versions?
I haven't changed anything, so it's old. I have not installed anything.
Okay, another option is to install fresh versions of that browser. They might update the security certificates, and so it may go away simply with that. The reason for everyone out there, in case Andy has to leave to go shopping, different companies want to have a financial presence. It's a big money-making deal. Microsoft has its browser so that it can push Bing as a search engine instead of Google. Google Chrome has Google Chrome, so it can push Google. And Firefox, I don't know. I'm sure there's some financial aspect to Firefox. And actually, there's probably about 10 or 15 other browsers out there that are available that are free. And different people have different preferences, and their preferences change over time. Microsoft probably is the least used but most built into engine. Some people are Firefox people, some people are Chrome people. And as I said before, there are other browsers out there that a few connoisseurs appreciate old standard stuff. And I run all kinds of three for different reasons, because I have automated software that doesn't recognize the difference between tabs and browsers, and so I have to have it work on a different web browser to recognize that that's the one that I wanted to do open windows, close windows, move windows around, and do all kinds of fun stuff on my computers and such. So there's a reason why there's more than one or two web browsers, but if it makes you feel any better, the engine that powers most of them is made by the same exact people.
Kitty Swim BB.
Yes, Bob, sounding a lot better this time, by the way.
Yeah, that's the first thing I was going to say. I doubled from half power to full power. I'm now at 50 watts. So maybe I could repeat briefly what I said before and didn't get heard.
Sure, give it a go. You got to keep in mind that, especially for us poor guys in Brooklyn, I need 150 watts to be heard. So, yeah, 50 watts is kind of a minimum around here.
Yeah, I basically forgot before. I hadn't talked to Limark lately, and it used to be easier. Anyway, yeah, I have a Mac, and I have an older Mac OS, not as old as Windows 7, but Apple kind of forces their obsolescence faster. It's called El Capitan, which is 10.11, and they're up to, well, now they're up to 11, OS 11 point, I don't know what, one maybe, and they went up to 14 or something before that, so this thing's about 5 years old. But it just started happening, to my knowledge. I mean, I wasn't using the computer for 3 days or so because I was too busy, but I didn't notice until yesterday. It works on Firefox. It does not, I get that problem with both Chrome, which is what I was using, and Safari, which is the built-in Apple browser. But so far, no problem on Firefox. I just went to QRZ with no problem, and I just tried some other websites, and a bunch of things I have left out. So it seems to work for me on Firefox. So maybe that's about all I have to report now. But yeah, that same exact error that Andy was reporting is what I've been getting. So back to you, Ray.
Yeah, it's curious. It's not a global problem. It seems to be a problem with one or two websites. So I'm thinking that it's some strange interaction. It's kind of like, you know, my assumption, my guess is that the website updated its security certificate in such a way that these browsers are unaware of the updated security code, and so they're not reading them as legitimate. But this is all supposition, because I don't know anyone who's complained to me, at least, that they get that for a whole swath of websites. It usually happens to one or two or three websites that ultimately tend to be kind of closely connected. They sort of run on the same servers.
Yeah, Ben VB here. My limited experience, because it's only been happening for 24 hours of my experience or less, there's a bunch of websites that didn't work on the other two browsers, but so far, no problems. The Firefox, too early, I would say, to say it's completely gone from Firefox, but I don't know, it's strange. And the fact that it didn't come until the last couple of few days, something must have been changed out there. I don't know. All right, back to you, Roy.
Well, you got to keep in mind that the change is in the air. If you've been keeping a look at the calendar and websites, October 5th, which is only in 2 days, is when Windows 11 comes out. And there's more than a few servers that are kind of tweaking and updating their software. So I wouldn't at all be surprised if it has something to do with update tweaks prior to the onslaught of Windows 11 meeting and greeting us all.
Yeah, probably so. I'm just, a similar topic is I'm wondering why you said Firefox is the same engine as Chrome, which surprised me because I always thought Firefox was this, maybe things have changed since my last update on information. Also, Firefox was like Mozilla, and it was this open source thing that it's been Netscape like 20 or more years ago, and more than 20 years ago. And but I don't know, maybe you're right. Maybe Google bought it up or something, and I just haven't been up on that stuff lately. So anyway, back to Ned.
I think it's pretty much a matter of cross-licensing that Google is probably started off using their source code to begin with, and they became the major player. So, you know, you could theoretically say that they're all Firefox engines, but since the kind of took over the role of tweaking, adjusting the ultimate little kernel that it all runs on is Google, you know, everyone calls it the Chrome engine. But they probably have the same lineage. They've been kind of joined at the hip for a long, long time. It was sort of Microsoft Internet Explorer that was the odd man out. They were going to write their own thing. And they tried repeatedly and failed. So finally, they just got up, wiped the dirt off and said, okay, I'm going to join the club too, guys. And so, you know, it's three different flavors of vanilla.
But one thing, it seems like Firefox is, as so far, I'm not encountered that problem, so there must be some kind of difference.
They're not identical. They just have major kernels that run them all. How they implement the kernel is slightly different, and the version number also is an important aspect. They all build little added-on features to the tabs and how they're organized and little extra features, and they into the builds every so often. I know with my Google Chrome, there's a nice big update button, so it doesn't sneak up on you. But Firefox, just when you launch a new version, when you launch a new window of it, it kind of flashes a quick updating window and goes away for a little while and then comes back. Hopefully somewhat smarter. And Edge has their own way of dealing with updates. So you have slightly different versions with slightly different variations on how to solve the same problem. And so they're not identical. They're slightly different. But ultimately, when you really look at all three of them, there's not that much difference between all three of them.
talking about the security certificate.
Yes, that was part of our conversation. The HTTPS uses a certificate, a security certificate, and something is disrupting the browser's ability to recognize it as a legitimate certificate, and so it's being blocked as an unsecure website.
QSL. Sometimes I have to update my security certificates for my website, and sometimes, you know, it reads insecure for a very short time, and then when I update it, it goes back to secure.